Save mental energy managing your WordPress site with easy-to-use DIY features from WP Engine's Managed WordPress Hosting. Visit wpengine.com/loveyourwork for up to 4 months free. This is Love Your Work. Wherever you are in your journey towards entrepreneurial enlightenment, we have the people and the tools to help you carve out your own version of success. I'm David Cadvey, and I'm a best-selling author and entrepreneur. I have built a business and life according to my own values, and I want to help you do the same. So every Thursday, I love bringing you a new episode in which I dissect the unique path of a guest. How did they turn struggles into opportunities? How did they cut out the noise to focus? And where were the clues that led them to their calling? Or I bring you lessons from my own journey. And if this is your first time listening, be sure to check out some of our most popular episodes, Jason Fried on episode 1, Ryan Holiday on episode 31, and Elise Bauer on episode 33. And also, if this is your first time listening, I promise my audio is usually better. I'm back in my apartment in Chicago, and it's just plain noisy. Listen, you can hear like just big engines driving by all the time. It's not a good place for recording a podcast, but I'm here to move. I'm selling all my worldly possessions and moving to Colombia, going minimalist. But as you're listening to this right now, I'm in a really quiet place, a quieter place than the place that I'm in while I'm recording this. I'm on a quiet pond somewhere in the North Woods of Wisconsin. And why am I not recording there? Well, because I'm taking a break. Some people would call it a vacation. There's something about that word that I really don't like. But that's where I am. And then the next week, I'm going to spend clearing out the apartment and getting rid of everything and moving. It's an exciting change. I've spent so much time in Colombia the past few years doing what I call mini lives. You can learn more about those on episode 5 if you haven't heard about them already. I've been going there so much, it's just not really a big change. It's kind of been a slow motion move. So while I'm relaxing, and as I'm sure many of you are also relaxing this time of year, I thought it would be a good time to put myself on the other side of the mic. So on this week's episode, I am the guest, actually. I was recently on my friend Al Mogg's new podcast, which is called Unstagnate. And he did such a good job of researching and teasing out the things that I've been thinking about lately that I just decided that it would be great to share it with you. And he was kind enough to let me do that. So in this discussion, I'll share the rituals and thought frameworks I used to write my first book, Design for Hackers, in about half the time most books like it take to write. Now, bear in mind, that's total time from book deal to book release. It actually was 12 hours a day of total agony, but I'll tell you about the cohesive personal productivity system that I've devised to make my flow states happen at the right times to make that quality creative work come out quicker. You're also going to hear the story behind how that first book even happened, how I set up my life so that when an opportunity like that came along, I would be ready for it. And then how did I get the opportunity to work with behavioral scientist Dan Ariely on features that are now being integrated into Google Calendar, such as goals and reminders, which you might have seen some of those features pop up. And also in this conversation, you're going to find out why you might want to grab a pen before you grab your morning coffee, how to create a virtuous cycle of productivity to train yourself to focus more deeply, why is it so important to develop a well-defined worldview, how do I weigh the pros and cons of various ways of naming things, such as my book, Design for Hackers, and this podcast, Love Your Work, how does the name of this podcast tie into landing big guests like Steve Case and Jason Fried? And how do I convince such busy people to be so generous with their time? Here we go. It's me. Want to maximize your email marketing? You should try ActiveCampaign. I switched last year from MailChimp, and I love it. With email marketing, marketing automation, and a sales CRM, it's a powerful, intuitive, and complete platform. Claim your 14-day free trial of ActiveCampaign at activecampaign.com/loveyourwork.
So, Dave, you launched a book called Design for Hackers. When was this?
This was 2011 was when it came out. September 14, 2011 was launch day.
Okay, and you have a background as a graphic designer. And walk me through how the process of writing the book went for you. So the book itself, first off, what is the book about?
Well, the book is Design for Hackers, Reverse Engineering Beauty. So I basically reverse engineer what it is that makes a design a beautiful design. There's like these factors or layers that always come together in every great design to make it a great design. And so the aim then is to help the reader understand how to see things the way that a designer does.
Right.
The way that a designer does see things. So you know, it's not so much like, oh, here's a tip, do this, don't do that. It's more of a, here's a framework through which to understand what makes a design.
Which is a very interesting concept in and of itself, you know, like taking something that people see as subjective and breaking it down. So I could see why that book became a success. But I'm wondering about the actual process of writing the book. So you end up coming up with the idea of the book, or you got actually a book deal, right?
Yeah, I mean, I was experimenting with a lot of different things. I sort of felt like, oh, I have something within me and I don't know what it is. And so I just spent a lot of time experimenting with a lot of different things and wrote different blog posts on various topics and eventually wrote about design. And that was very popular and very quickly got an email from a publisher asking if I'd like to write a book about design. So that's how that's how I ended up landing the book deal.
Okay. And so you get a book deal. How long do you have to write the book? 6 months?
I had six months. It is, it was a technology, so quote unquote technology book, which, you know, kind of put in the same category as like, oh, here's a book on learning Python or JavaScript or something. However, it's a different sort of writing, you know. It was more abstract.
Sure.
Like I kind of want to say like Gladwell style type writing. And so a book like that, typically there's maybe a 4.5 month writing period. I got it extended to 6.
Yep.
Which was still pretty short. I mean, it was from the time of getting the book deal to launching the book is roughly 1 year. And, you know, if most books, if it's not like a quote unquote technology book, it will be about 2 years from book deal to launch.
Yeah.
For traditional publish.
And so walk me through how it feels to actually, you know, have a book deal, which is something that you clearly wanted, and then now having to contend with the fact that you have to write this book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It was funny. It felt something felt very normal or like, okay, about time about it, because I had been, you know, working for something like that, like for a very long time. I had been on my own for 3 years at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 3 years prior to that, I sort of got fired from my job. And like, even in that meeting, I said to my boss, oh, thanks. You know, this is going to be a special day in my life, July 17, 2007. I'm thinking like, well, I'm never going to work for somebody else again. So it was like, I felt like I had something of value to share, but I needed to just put in the time, like experimenting with a lot of different things before that would happen. And so I had tried so many different things and I had set up everything so that I would be ready for something like that. Like I was purposely, you know, doing a limited amount of freelancing and setting up passive revenue streams so that I would be able to free up more of my time to do more exploration. And so actually the timing worked out perfectly. One of my best clients kind of wound down around that time. And then when I got the book deal, one of my passive revenue streams really shot up, which was good because, you know, the advance of a first time author for a book like that is not very big. So I kind of needed some extra money to get by while writing the book. So it was like so much had been set up for that,
yeah,
that I felt pretty ready. But it was still a lot of pressure.
And then I guess,
you know, I had a contract.
I guess where I'm getting at is, you know, I read on your blog where you write about how you sat in front of your laptop for 12 hours a day only to get to about 15 to 20 minutes worth of good writing.
Yeah, I mean, it was a dark time in my life. It was the worst 6 months of my life, for sure. Which is a silly, you know, it sounds silly, like, oh, you just, oh, woe is me, I have a book deal, I've got to write a book. And it took 6 months, but it was just something about it that was very, very stressful. And, you know, not everything else in my life was going great at the time necessarily. And I had never written anything that long before. I had certainly written a lot of blog posts, lots of long, detailed blog posts. And to be in a position where I had to be creative on command like that, it was a lot of trying to pull apart what are the different phases of achieving like a great insight or a creative idea. And yeah, every once in a while, it was a lot of banging my head against the wall. And then eventually, oh, all of a sudden I just write an entire chapter in one sitting or something. Yeah. Like, where did that come from? How can I make that happen again? Is there any rhyme or reason to that?
Yeah. Yeah. And so when you talk about having an entire chapter suddenly write itself out, is that experience for you an experience of flow?
Yeah. That's flow. I mean, that's time goes by and you're feeling good and the pain, like the physical pain, there's so much physical pain in writing. There's no pain.
Mm.
When you're doing
what physical pain, by the way, what's the physical pain that you experience while writing? The hands or just sitting down all day?
Oh, you don't experience that? Well, I mean, there is another element to this, which is that I, you know, recently discovered that I had, or like over the last couple of years, discovered that I have like chronic inflammation all the time. I'm going to use air quotes and call it chronic Lyme disease. That's what my doctor thinks it is, but I realize that's like a controversial thing to say. It's not a very straightforward thing, but for whatever reason, okay, I've got like a lot of inflammation and stuff going on in my body. So like, I honestly did have like pain in my fingers,
right,
that I didn't really know was there because I had been there for like 15 years. Mm. But
that pain went away while you were in the state of flow.
That didn't necessarily know, but there is like this other pain that was like in the chest of, like, existential pain of, I've got to write this and I like can't move.
Right.
And it's this feeling of paralysis.
Right.
And, you know, and on top of it, there's like the existential stuff is also like, okay, here, I'm this guy who has spent the last 3 years, being a dilettante on my own. And, you know, people and family or friends in my life are kind of like, what the hell is David doing all the time? And like, I need to prove that, you know, I'm doing something, and this is
right.
This is my opportunity for that too. So there's that existential layer, like.
And so at the end of it, the book gets written. It becomes a success. I think hits number 18 on the Amazon bestseller list. You're now a best-selling author. And which I guess makes you someone that people are more likely to listen to. And you keep blogging, and
yeah, it's crazy.
And what you have in mind now is, yeah, I loved reading that where you said something, I think in your latest Quora, where you said something along the lines of,
wow, it's you more, really did a lot of research.
It's more likely that people in random social situations would consider me an interesting intellectual rather than an eccentric, which is cool.
Oh, life pre and post best-selling author. It's completely different. Just
so you recommend it.
Different thing. Yeah, I recommend it. Definitely.
So you're now a best-selling author, and you're starting to write, and now tell me if I'm getting the timeline wrong, but you start writing more about productivity. You start writing more about producing, being creative, and somehow one of your new blog posts captures the attention of people at Timeful. Is that right so far?
Yeah. So productivity is something that, well, first of all, I don't know. I feel like productivity is one of these things that everybody thinks they know something
right.
about. And, you know, everybody has like their own philosophies about it because you're producing stuff all day. And it's also something you can write about that it's easier than doing actual work. So I'm, you know, I've definitely done like a lot of that myself. But I mean, actually, I was writing about productivity for a while. I think like the first time I was on Lifehacker was maybe 2006. Mm-hmm. And I've been, Lifehacker has covered my writing, okay, you know, maybe 15 times or something like that. So it was always sort of like in the, it was always in, you know, in the background there. And as somebody who makes things, I'm totally interested in productivity. And as somebody who makes things, I'm always trying to find the best way to make things, to actually get myself to do these things that I want to do that, but you know, my dumb brain doesn't want to do. So especially this experience of banging my head against the wall 12 hours a day to get this 15 minutes of flow, throughout the experience of writing, I definitely started to develop rituals. I started to develop a sense of what was going on in my brain, kind of a sense of, okay, what am I feeling in my brain right now? Is it time for me to research? Is it time for me to do some outlining? Is it time for me to do a barf draft? Is it time for me to proofread and edit and polish some of the things I've already mm-hmm. written? Like, those are all different brain states. Mm-hmm. And so I got very attuned to that and interested in mm-hmm. that. And so just to write a sort of general theory of everything on that, I wrote a blog post called Productivity is About Mind Management, Not Time Management. And I got an email from an entrepreneur, and he was partnering with Dan Ariely, the author of Predictably Irrational and, you know, pioneering
behavioral scientist,
behavioral economist. Yeah. And yeah, they were making this company called Timeful, and they thought, you know, I was very resistant to talk to them even because I was kind of heads down on some other stuff. But when we finally did talk, he was like, I think you're going to see that we were meant to work together on this. So, you know, once he told me what they were up to, I agreed.
What were they up to? Tell us a bit more about Timeful. So if your idea of productivity is about mind management, working with the right mental states and being in the right mental state for the work you're doing, how did Timeful fit in with that?
Yeah, I mean, they were trying to, you know, obviously with Dan Ariely, they were trying to integrate knowledge about behavioral science, behavioral change, into productivity. And they were also bringing in big data and artificial intelligence to sort of make the goal was to make a predictive kind of calendar, which could tell you, oh, like, I've got these goals that I need to meet, and I have these things that need to be done, and then I have these parts of my schedule that are non-negotiable. You know, tell me when I should do these
things. And these things would be like, you know,
and actually, by the way, yeah, sorry to interrupt, but at the time, though, that wasn't even what it was. It was really just, it was very nebulous. It was, we did so many different experimental little widget things, and it was just like, all right, well, how do we reconcile what we know about behavioral science with this philosophy of mind management instead of time management, and limitations of, you know, having an app as the tool and such. So,
yeah,
you know, what I explained is what it became, but it started with a philosophy.
Right.
And that was kind of where my role was as just an advisor. You know, I just talked to them an hour a week. Their design team is like, I've got the design background. I've got some behavioral science knowledge. I have the productivity philosophy. And so
you were meant to work together.
I was helping to condense this. And I already had mock-ups from years before of ideas for productivity apps and such. So
At the end of it, Timeful, I was always waiting because you were writing on your blog and I've been following your stuff for a while, and you're always talking about Timeful is going to be released in 2014. And then eventually they got acquired by Google to be integrated into Google Calendar. And I think just recently I saw that some of the features of Timeful, or what was Timeful, are starting to become integrated in Calendar, which is, I mean, that must feel great. Being you, because I mean, Timeful is an app still trying, even the conception ideas, it would be something that would try to break in, try to get people downloading it, try to get people using it in a platform like Google Calendar. It's just there. People are going to use it. The audience is already there.
Yeah.
And so, for example,
yeah,
if I get this right, and please correct me if I'm wrong, they show in their little explainer video how a guy is trying to get into yoga. And so he kind of like puts yoga into his calendar, but he puts it in not as something scheduled, but I forgot what it's called. And then a friend calls him up and says, hey, let's meet this afternoon. And so he's like, oh, okay, I'll meet her this afternoon. And the yoga section of his calendar just gets automatically transferred to another day to make sure that he meets his goals of doing
yoga. Wait, is this in Google Calendar?
Yeah.
Is this in Google Calendar now? Oh, okay. See, I haven't been up on it, but that's totally a timeful thing.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. There's things like that. And there's nothing that I can say to, like, oh, that was my idea. Mm-hmm. You know, like, they had a whole team of people and they were working very hard to do all these things. And I really just was sitting down with them once a week to help polish things out and make sure things work, but work with the philosophy. But yeah, it is very cool to see those things. And it's great also because, you know, oftentimes Google will buy a company and then, you know, they just kill it and, you know, see the technology. But yeah, they're definitely doing it. One of the things that I loved about Timeful, my favorite feature really was just the to-dos. You could say, this seems so obvious that it's just smack your forehead obvious. Take a to-do item, estimate how long it's going to be, and then drag it onto your calendar. When are you going to do it? When are you going to have the time to do this? Because so many people's, this is a behavioral science thing, you know, so many people, their eyes are bigger than their than their mouths, right?
So they write a big to-do list and it never gets done. They never schedule it in.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it's like, hey, genius, you wrote down 10 things you're going to do today. When are you going to do all those things?
Yeah, right.
And so, and actually, I mean, I hardly even need it. Now Timeful, the actual app is, you know, they took it offline, but I hardly even need it now just because I got trained so well in using it with just like, oh, these are the things I want to do today. How long do I think those are going to, these things are going to take? And then, you know, there's the timeline as I'm doing the things and I realize, oh, I'm really bad at estimating how long it takes to do things. Maybe I should adjust my estimates. Yes. And so now I've gotten a lot better.
So what is your rule of thumb? You just say for everything that you say you're going to do in 30 minutes, you just give it 50 minutes, you give it an hour, you double the time, 50%.
Yeah. I mean, I realized that there's buffer time of switching mental states. Mm-hmm. Like what mental state do I have to be in to do this sort of thing? And what time of, and for me, the way I do things these days is that there's sort of cycles to things. You know, we all have our peak and off-peak times. And for many people, their off-peak time is in the morning. And that's certainly true for me. I'm a little groggy. I'm not really sharp in the morning. And there's a neuroscientist named John Cuneos, who's been a guest on my podcast. And he studies the nature of insight. And so he's done some groundbreaking studies on, okay, when people have insights, like aha moments, creative thinking, what are the conditions of that? And actually having a weak prefrontal cortex, as you do when it's your off-peak time, correlates with solving insight problems better. So I use that as a tool to say, okay, morning is writing time. First thing in the morning, I get up, I spend the first hour writing a 500-word Medium article and publishing that out. Like, I'm a little groggy, but like, that's my best time for writing.
Is that the absolute first thing that you do, Dave? When you wake up in the morning, you just get up and sit in front of the laptop and start writing?
Well, I put on clothes.
Okay, that's good.
You know, maybe
brush your teeth.
Might have to take some supplements or go to the restroom. Or I probably usually don't brush my teeth even before I do it, just to give you too much information. But lately I've been meditating for, you know, 10 lousy minutes before. But yeah, first thing, I go, I have a place where I can stand up with my computer. So I do that first hour standing up. And that's kind of a new habit of just 500 words. I give myself roughly an hour.
Yeah.
And it's so scary. So
that's pretty interesting, Dave. I'll tell you why. Because I get up and I'm groggy in the morning, like pretty much, I don't know, most people that I know. And the first thing that I want to do before I do anything is to have a cup of coffee and then have another one before I even start doing anything. And so, yeah, you're
wasting your best, your most precious resource.
So what's so good about grogginess?
I could be totally wrong because, well, I could be totally wrong about this. I'm sure it's different for everybody, but this is supported by research. You know, people with damaged prefrontal cortexes, which you don't want to damage prefrontal cortex, but people with damaged prefrontal cortexes, they solve insight problems at a higher rate than people with healthy brains.
Right.
And so when you are groggy in the morning, that is a time when, you know, the fact that I like write and finish and ship an article while I'm in that state is, you know, it's a little daredevilish. But if it as a time to, you know, sit down and just write things and think creatively or not without an aim, especially without an aim, that's where your insight comes and creative thinking comes from. Like, it's called remote associates thinking. It's these different regions of your brain sort of colliding with one another. And when your prefrontal cortex is weak, that, you know, your prefrontal cortex is like the executive that says, okay, this part of the brain is going to talk to that part of the brain. And, you know, it's like mission control. But when mission control is down, then these other parts of the brain can start to play with each other more. So you can have like more creative.
And so for you, it's creative writing. What if someone isn't a creative writer? Let's say someone who, you know, just works a corporate job. What can they use that time for in their day? Because you said it's not very aimful, you know, you don't have an aim. Yeah. What do you take that time? Just to write stuff out and figure out new ideas? What would you say?
I mean, I think it's hard for me to, I'm biased about writing. I just think everybody should write.
Yeah.
And I have a hard time imagining, I'm sure there are plenty of people who are, but I have a hard time imagining like how somebody could, you know, really be a successful human without writing. So, but that's me. I'm biased. Now if you're working a corporate job but you're a knowledge worker and your output isn't so much, oh, I typed really fast today, but I came up with this great idea that's going to increase revenues, etc., then I would think that you may have heard it, you know, James Altucher's idea of the idea muscle. Sit down and write 10 ideas. And so many people don't take the time to go ahead and write down things that they realize, that they knowing full well beforehand that there's no goal in mind, that they're probably not going to use any of this, and that they're really just exercising that idea muscle. So I think if you sat down and before you even had your coffee, you were just like writing down crazy ideas about how accounting and sales and marketing can all work together. Whatever
that's
people
cool.
do in corporate jobs, I can't remember.
That's cool. I have something to say about that. A while ago, and I wish I could find that reference because I've been looking for that reference, but I'm sure I read it somewhere, right? So with that in mind, I remember that there were a group of psychologists that tried to quantify what creativity was, because creativity is like porn. You know that you're seeing porn, but it would be really hard to define porn. And so they try to see like, what does a general or like a business person who's very creative have in common with an artist or a painter that you also see is very creative. And it's a very nebulous kind of quality to define in someone. And all of the tests that they tried to do to try to find similarities between these people found nothing, absolutely nothing, until they found that one thing, which was that people who are creative have that habit of respecting their own ideas and writing down their own ideas. And that was it. That was the only thing. That was the only thing. So yeah. I think creativity and writing down your own ideas, and they didn't necessarily even follow up on them, but just that act of committing something to paper or, I mean, a computer in this day and age, which I know you have strong opinions about, you'd take the paper over the computer, makes you more creative. I've got something to talk to you about productivity and creativity. You talk about weekly routines versus daily routines. First off, with weekly routines, this is pretty funny. We were trying to schedule this podcast in. We're talking and it's a Thursday evening for you and a Friday morning for me. And we were supposed to do it last week and I was just booked for something. And I'm like, oh, okay, do you have another day? And you just booked me in for exactly a week after that.
Oh, yeah.
So you have a day that you do podcasts, and maybe just explain that in the framework of how you look at your week or weekly routine.
Yeah, I mean, doesn't everybody do this? No. I think
not everyone podcasts.
I try to have a yeah, well, but like I take my week on a, everything's on cycles, right? And there's like cycles inside of cycles, and there's these gears that fit in within one another. And so, you know, mornings are my good creative time. Early afternoon is better sharp time, or actually even like late morning is better sharp work time. And then as the day goes on, it becomes like more of a good idea for me to have meetings or other sort of social things, because my brain gets tired, my willpower runs low. And that's what happens with me on the week too, is that Wednesday, Thursday, Friday are time for podcast interviews, or if there's going to be some sort of meeting and I don't really have like a set, this particular thing needs to be done in this way.
Mm-hmm. Is that supported by Monday research, by the way, that your will, is that supported by research that your willpower gets diminished throughout the week?
I'm not super well versed on the willpower research, but I do understand at least that generally the idea is that willpower is a limited resource. Sure. And it's something that as I pay attention to myself, I realize when I'm capable of doing something that requires willpower and when I have a hard time. So when I have a hard time, instead of trying to push myself and then feeling bad about myself, then I just sort of give myself permission to be a little more aimless.
Yeah.
So yeah, Mondays and Tuesdays for me are like, I'm excited on Monday. I'm like, I can't wait to get up and work on my most important project. And there's no meetings on Mondays or Tuesdays unless it's super important. So no offense, Almog, but
that's okay.
But that way I know that on Monday, if I really, I'm allowed, I can get in the groove on something and I don't have to check my calendar or there's nothing on my schedule. It's just create stuff. And then, yeah, I have a tendency, I know, to go pretty hard on, say, Monday and Tuesday. And then later on in the week, it's like I'm a little, I don't really have as much power to stay focused and stay on task.
Yeah.
And that's when I get energy out of talking to people.
Yeah.
Or having conversations about things. So, like, you know, we're going to have this free-form conversation. And I think you were hinting to this before we talked that, we're going to have this freeform conversation. You're going to ask me what you think is interesting about what I do. And then I'm going to talk about it. And it's going to be me talking about things in a new way. And that will somehow help me sharpen my own understanding of myself.
Yeah, awesome.
Right. And so it's like, there's not like an aim to this conversation necessarily, but it's valuable. So,
yeah. Yeah.
So I work with the cycles, and I work that way throughout the year. Even December, I specifically, you know, had opportunities to maybe do some sort of partnership where I could make some money, and I just said no to everything because I needed to have time to reevaluate the direction that I was headed in. And since December is this time where everybody has holidays and such, and people are kind of a little more lazy with work, and there's that whole period of time where there's really just nobody working, it's a great time to give your brain a rest.
Yeah.
And then the new year comes, and then you can regroup. And so it's all in cycles.
Yeah.
And I try to work with those cycles. We're going to take a quick break. Being productive in your business is all about mind management, not time management, which is why I use WP Engine's Managed WordPress Hosting to host all of my WordPress sites. They have really easy to use DIY tools, so managing my site is as simple as can be, and I can focus my mental energy on the things that I do best, like bringing you this show. I don't have to worry about installing WordPress, I don't have to worry about keeping it up to date, and I don't have to worry about backups or security. WP Engine takes care of all of it for me. With WP Engine's tools, you can quickly launch new sites, protect existing sites, and test plugin updates. They back up everything daily, and you can make changes on the staging version of your WordPress site before pushing your changes live. They also have a built-in CDN. And what does that mean? That means that your WordPress site is super fast.
Visit wpengine.com/loveyourwork for up to 4 months free with WP Engine.
This is what I think about your productivity ideas, having read quite a lot in the last few days before this interview. Have you heard of Monty Roberts? Roberts is the real horse whisperer. He's the guy who inspired the book, The Horse Whisperer. And there's a book called The Man Who Listens to Horses. A great book, by the way. A really, really good book. And it just, apparently, before Monty Roberts, the way that you would break a horse would be by force. So you would tie the horse's leg and you would use a lot of force to get the horse to submit to your will to start doing what you want. And Monty Roberts started following these wild horses in the outback of America. Do you call it outback in America? Either way, the plains of America, where horses roam free. And he started noticing from afar, because you can't get really close to them, how the alpha horse treats the young horses and gets them to start following them, and how they deal with a stubborn horse or with a horse that's acting badly. He took that into training horses. I actually haven't seen the Horse Whisperer movie, but basically the way horses are trained today is by creating this relationship of trust with the horse. And that all comes from natural observation, from the natural world. Now, to take it into the way you do things, I think that a lot of productivity people try to force people, or force themselves really, into a pattern, force themselves into kind of this mechanical, robotical type of work, whereas you seem to kind of say, no, well, you know, there is a nature. There is a nature of how I am and how I work, and I'm going to work with it, right? And so, and also...
That's a great observation.
And, very helpful. And it's a nice metaphor, because you talk about the lizard brain, and we talk about how there's, you know, fears and issues and primitive brains parts inside us that have resistance to doing this kind of work. And we have to work with them. So in a real way, we're kind of working to tame our own inner animal when we're trying to get anything done. It's really like training a horse or training a dog.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And so seeing that...
So I'm like the productivity whisperer.
You're the productivity whisperer, yeah. And so seeing that your ideas about productivity are that different to other people's ideas on productivity, do you even get use from other people's productivity advice? Is there someone that you follow? Because I could see how all the things you were saying about how, well, you know, I like to rest later on in the week, then people would be like, Dave, it sounds like you've got ADD. And you need to get on medication so that you could focus on Thursday and Friday and get the important work that you need to get done.
I mean, I do stuff on Thursday and Friday. I do like boring stuff. Like if I have to do accounting, or, you know, if I have to like review some financial statements or something, that's going to get done on Friday, because it's like that's stuff I don't like. And it's stuff I don't want to get in the way of the most important work.
Right. I guess my question was, was there someone that you follow or someone who gives good advice, or do you just come up with your ideas based on your own experiences and nothing else when it comes to productivity?
Well, I mean, I definitely have been inspired a lot by the behavioral economists, you know,
right.
Dan Ariely, Daniel Kahneman, and I've been interested in psychology for so long. So those have been inspirations, and I don't feel like that stuff has been integrated into productivity very well, which is, you know, I've been exploring a new book idea based around some of the stuff we're talking about.
You could call it the Productivity Whisperer.
That might be the name of the book. That's like pretty awesome. That's an awesome story. That's actually really great. But one of the things that I ran into was I spent 3 months writing a book proposal, and then I realized that the book that I wrote the proposal for already exists. And it had just come out. It's called Deep Work by Cal Newport.
Right.
I think his approach is a little bit different. He's definitely more like, okay, you're a knowledge worker, and your output isn't measured by like how many words you typed in the last hour. It's measured by what's the quality of your ideas and the quality of your work, and you should optimize for that. So And there's some training stuff that he has in the book about that. And I haven't really figured out exactly where I differ now, but I've been trying to regroup there. But this horse, productivity whisperer thing is good. And that's a great observation, because it's definitely something that I look at with productivity, is that, yeah, there are these forces that you can use. You can use them against themselves in a way, like motivational judo is kind of what I call it, is that your ego has this thing, or at least most people's ego has this thing. This is the way mine works anyway, is that, yeah, if I dream about doing this really elaborate big thing, then I can just fantasize about that and never start. And I might feel good about it, just thinking about how great it's going to be. Now, if instead I give myself not make any progress, and if instead I give myself a ridiculously easy goal, like I have a thing called the 10-minute hack, which is basically set a timer for 10 minutes. All you need to do is just work on this thing for 10 minutes without checking Facebook or anything. It's like such an easy goal that, at least the way my ego works, there's no way I'm going to fail at that, because I'll feel so bad about myself if I fail at that, that I won't let myself fail at this ridiculously easy goal. So I have made a habit of giving myself ridiculously easy goals to sort of like build the habit first and then worry about, am I getting the results I want?
Yeah.
Another case is like this thing I call the first hour rule. And that's what I use to write that book proposal. It's, 16,000 words long. Was the first hour of every morning I worked on my book proposal. If an hour was up and I was like dying, then I was done. Like I could feel good that I worked on the book proposal that day. But I did that every day. And then eventually it started to take over my brain,
right,
to where eventually it was taking over my whole day.
Right. I really like that, Dave. So instead of like, strong arming yourself into sitting down and writing the entire book proposal in one day and writing it for 7 hours straight, you're just like, yep, I'm going to do this first hour in the morning. And like you said, if you're dying by the end of it, if you hate it every second, you were compassionate with yourself and you're like, okay, that's good work for the day. We'll continue tomorrow. Yeah.
Good job. We're going to come back tomorrow. And it has worked. It has worked really well. I've been doing it with the gym as well. And it's just like, you just have to go to the gym 3 days a week.
Yep.
It's like, you don't have to do everything. Just make the habit of going to the gym and then things start to happen.
Have you read the book, Motivation Hacker, by the way?
No, that's a great name for a book.
Yeah.
Though.
It's a guy who tried to take on 16 very hard, different tasks, very different tasks in, a span of 3 months, and how he combined all these motivational hacks to get himself to do things. I'd love to have him on the show. His name is Nick Winters.
It's a
great,
yeah,
book. I think that was the first time I wrote an Amazon review for anything, and I just loved it. And yeah, so a recommendation. Dave, you built your life around exploration, mental exploration, and the ability to have the time to explore ideas and think things through, right? Would that be a fair assessment?
Yeah, I think that's really accurate. I know whenever I had a regular job, I just constantly felt paralyzed, like everybody around me was moving too fast.
Yeah.
And that I wanted to slow down and think about things. And, I was always frustrated that people weren't thinking things through. So definitely lots of time, lots of unstructured time.
Now look, the way I think about it is that when you look back at past generations, they were creating, they were craving that. They were craving unstructured time to do what they want with it. People were working for a really long time. We created all these devices, all these kitchenware devices, everything to allow us more comfort and more free time. And now, in a way, we just fill it in with mindless things like browsing Facebook, for example. And I think for people who fought so hard to liberate our time, if they looked and saw what we were doing with our time now, many of us, not you necessarily, mm-hmm, they would be upset. They'd be like, this is what we worked so hard for, and now this is what you're doing with your free time?
Yeah, this is sort of Is this like the burden of first world problems? If you have like the privilege of being able to spend a lot of unstructured time, like that's actually quite a duty. And there's a number of ways you can use that, you know, in a useful way. And I may be fooling myself, but I like to think that using that time to think about experience and write things about it and hopefully shape the way that minds think about the world is an effective way to
I can't think freedom. Of a better way, really. Maybe wrong, you know, kind of like meditating and achieving inspiration.
Well, I could go volunteer somewhere or something. Someone could make an argument for that, I guess.
Okay.
but this is one particular way that I can use the things that I'm good at. I wouldn't fare too well in rural Africa.
Always about curiosity and new ideas and exploration rather than making more money and, you know, the kind of social markers of success?
Yeah, I think that it took me a while to realize it, but yeah, I always have done the thing that makes me less money. I mean, I can think back to when I was when I was getting my first internship in college, and I had an offer from an advertising firm, which was considered a prestigious advertising firm where I lived, and it was $7 an hour. And then there was this architecture firm that was kind of like stuffy and corporate, and it was $12 an hour, and it wasn't really what I wanted to do. And like my girlfriend and my girlfriend's parents and like everybody in my family was like, well, obviously, we're talking about an internship here, by the way. Like, you know, like you're supposed to get experience that is valuable to you. Like, you know, getting paid $12 an hour instead of getting paid $7 an hour isn't, you know, it's not supposed to be much of a consideration. But you can see that, you know, you can see in that the way that most people around me thought. And I didn't think that way. And, you know, I still think if I would have stayed in Silicon Valley and gone the career designer route, that I probably would have made more money than I've made so far. You know, like I could have joined Timeful at full time instead of being an advisor, you know, but it was just going to take up too much exploration time than, you know, more than I had. So, that's my main priority is understanding my own viewpoint of the world and trying to understand as much about the world as I can. And I think that I could be totally wrong, but I think that that's the way that somebody does something that has an impact is by, sometimes it happens by accident, but I mean, you listen to people who do things that are really brilliant and great. Like you listen to, this may sound like a strange example to some people, but you listen to like Louis C.K., if you listen to that guy talk, like in an interview, he has a very deep, well-structured understanding of the
world.
And
unique. And it's unique.
He knows exactly how it works. Unique. And he knows, he at least airtight what his viewpoint is. And his comedy, his work goes through that. And I think that if you don't have a good, well-defined viewpoint of the way things work, then you're just sort of stabbing in the dark.
Yeah. Out of that love and appreciation for new ideas, I think, comes your, and people that take time to think through and live a unique life, comes your podcast, Love Your Work. Would that be fair? That, and combine that with productivity and creativity.
Yeah. I mean, the podcasting is great because you get to explore and you don't necessarily have to polish everything. Like it's all right there in the conversation. It's interesting to me. I love podcasts. I love podcasts. I listen to them hours a day. And so that's, you know, one good reason why I enjoy being a podcaster.
Mm. And so,
but it's a great opportunity to explore and to talk to people who, when I see their work, I see that something's there, something's behind there that's more complex. And so I love being able to explore that and pick it apart and show those themes to other people.
Yeah. By the way, before we go into the podcast, I just realized I had one more question I didn't ask you. When you talk about thinking time, or like, you're pretty good at breaking down things. This is a theme, right? You broke down design for people who know nothing about design. You think about productivity and your own self in a way, you know, you break yourself down. Is there some kind of ritual or action that you take rather than, because I don't, you wrote that you take time to think, but you know, how do you differentiate that from just walking in the park and like the kind of thinking that you have when you drive your car, when you're in the supermarket? You know, we think all the time. What is structured thinking to you? What, how do you get yourself into that?
Yeah, I mean, those are different types of thinking, and it involves being attuned to my brain state. So one thing that I will do very often is I will go to a cafe in the afternoon, like after I've had a nice, good morning work session and got a lot of stuff done. And I will go, and my rule is that I only bring either my computer or my iPad. And I usually don't bring my computer. Like, it'll usually be my iPad. And I bring my notebook, my Moleskine. And I'll often sit there for hours just brainstorming, okay, what are different things I can do with the podcast? Or if I'm thinking about an interview, what are the themes that I want to come out of this interview? Do I have all the different pieces together about this person that through which I can create some sort of a cohesive conversation
right.
that has a theme to it? So that's one type of thinking. And then there is, you know, sometimes if I'm cooking, which I do a lot of cooking because I'm like always cooking for myself because I have like such a restrictive diet that like I always have to be cooking because I can't eat at any restaurants, which is one reason being a podcaster is a good outlet for me, is I'll listen to podcasts, but then sometimes I'll feel like my brain isn't ready for hearing things. It just needs to think, and that's on like a different level. And I will even sometimes if I'm about to go to the gym, I might prime myself and say, "Oh wait, what am I going to think about at the gym?" And are there any like nodes to this that I need to prime myself with and be ready so that when I go to the gym, I have enough information to at least like let things bounce off
and
one another. So I'm intentional about it.
What about breaking down things? When you break down your own behavior, when you broke down design, you know, for example, is that a matter of just fleshing down all your ideas and then trying to see how they combine? What's the, how they touch on each other and try to find like a diagram that makes them all fit in? Because arguably, it's pretty hard task to break down design for logical people, you know, and yet people say that you've done it.
Yeah.
Dave Kadavi did it.
Yeah. I don't know. This is something that when I was in design school, I felt a little different from the other designers in some ways. And that even during critiques or something is that I always tried to have a very specific reason why I made particular decisions. And I was very influenced by a history of design class that I took in college, where it just changed the way that I saw design of everything. And it, you know, you might talk about the design of a spoon or the design of a gun, or you know, what were the technologies that were available and what was going on culturally? Like, was there a rising middle class? So let's take impressionism, right? Like, there was neoclassicism, which was classical themes, very formally composed figures, and people, the aristocracy was really into this sort of thing. But then there was this rising middle class in France in the late 1800s, and then there were these guys hanging out in cafes drinking absinthe, and they start painting contemporary things that are going on. They start painting the middle class people hanging out in the park, having a picnic and things like that, and not the neoclassical themes. And then on top of that, there's this thing called photography that just came out. And like, well, if photography just came out and you're a painter, what does that mean to be a painter? Before, your job was to make things photorealistic. Well, now you start thinking about like, oh, well, paint is a thing. Paint and brushes are things. They have their own qualities. And so now you start seeing the brushwork in Impressionist paintings. That's why you have like these blurry things. So, I mean, all these things are present in everything. Everything anybody creates, anything anybody writes, everything anybody designs. There's always, you can analyze anything this way. Like, what does it mean to the person who created it? What does it mean to the society that there is? What's the technology that is there guiding this along? So it's not even just for design. This is how the whole world works. And you just see it over and over again enough times. And to me, that's really interesting.
This is what I got again from, you had a blog post or a podcast about stuff and things where you talk about how the world is full of stuff. And by the way, it's pretty confusing, but stuff could be.
Yeah, it is confusing. It's not all my stuff. Yeah. Not everything I write. Some things I write is very abstract, and it takes a while before they become accessible. And that's part of the process.
But I guess when you were talking about, I had to listen to that a few times before I really fully got. Maybe you should explain it, because I think you were just touching on it, and it would be good for our listeners to understand how and why you managed to break things down so well. And I think that's kind of key to it.
Well, I just think that the world is full of what I call stuff. Now, stuff is undefined stuff. Like we have insurance plans, right? So there's this idea that if you drive a car, that you're taking on a certain risk and bad things can happen. But there's a whole bunch of people who are also driving cars. And so since you can take less risk, if we all share the risk, there'll be this thing called an insurance policy. And, you know, before somebody said, let's make this thing called an insurance policy, there wasn't that. There was just these nebulous, there's this problem that when you drive a car, sometimes somebody sues you for millions of dollars, or you damage somebody's car, or kill somebody, things like that. And like the chances of you doing that are relatively low, but it.
And so when it was undefined, you call it a stuff. And when it became defined, you call it a thing.
It becomes a thing, And if the world is full of all these things that have yet to be defined, and as humanity progresses, as technology changes, as people's standards of living change, as people's ability to communicate with people in other cultures, as those things change, there's constantly new stuff that is starting to get enough form that it can be
things
made into a thing,
and then you take things and break it down.
I think that's like the basis of all of,
and then you take
it's the basis of all creation.
So taking stuff and making it into things, but also looking at things, seeing what stuff these things are made of, and then maybe you could make a new thing from that stuff.
Think of it like Steve Case, founder of AOL, America Online. As far as I'm concerned, the guy created the internet. He was on my podcast recently, and think about, it took him 10 years to get people on the internet. People thought, well, why would people want to be on the internet? As me as like a kid in Nebraska with unusual interests I remember thinking, why do I have to like hang out with the people who live in my neighborhood? What do I have in common with these people? Nothing. I don't like playing kickball. But for me to be able to connect suddenly, once I got on the internet and I could like go into chat room and I could chat with somebody somewhere else who was also into whatever I was into, like that was this untapped desire that was there. And it wasn't until the technology was available that it became possible for it to become a thing. And so many people didn't see it.
So it's
one example.
And so, you've got your podcast now, and podcast name is Love Your Work.
Love
Your Work, Dave Kadavi. And by the way, you are very good at naming things, I have to say. I really do.
You think so?
I like that, name. I like Love Your Work. I like Design for Hackers. You know, it kind of like it's punchy and it gets to the point. Actually, that brings me to another question, because, you know, we're starting this podcast here, and you've done well with your podcast that you've only recently launched. So it's a good time to ask you some questions about podcasting in general. I guess the first question is, you say love your work. Once you've given that name to your podcast, does that become limiting in the sense that you have to keep talking to people about stuff that have something to do with their work? Or can it just become the Dave Kadavi podcast where you talk about things that are interesting to you?
This is the great challenge of naming things in general, is that the more specific you are about something, the easier it is to be successful, but then that's the more limiting it is. So I was trying to strike a balance there. I considered making it the David Kadavi podcast or something, but I'm not like popular enough. I don't think I'm famous enough or popular enough. I'm not Tim Ferriss. I can't just say, I'll just call it the Tim Ferriss Show and whatever. It'll just be like the most popular podcast ever. It's not, I don't have that kind of clout not necessarily. Yet. Well, yeah, we'll see. But so I didn't feel like I could call the David Kadavi podcast. And I thought maybe that would be a little self-indulgent. And I tried so many different, the naming process takes a long time. I try a lot of different names. And I don't want it to be, the passive revenue podcast. Like I could make a podcast about passive revenue and people who are interested in passive revenue would search for it and they search for passive revenue and they'd be like, oh, we have the passive revenue podcast. But then I could only talk about passive revenue all the time. And I guess it turned out to be that loving your work is this thing that is sort of at the core or the root of what I'm about.
Yeah.
And has driven my life a lot. And it's not something, I don't think that it's not a name that is immediately going to be popular. It's not a name that people are going to come across and search, but it's at least something that if I'm consistent enough with it and I have enough quality that it will resonate with people. And there's something great about being able to send somebody an email with a subject line. Love your work in it.
Yeah, I like that a lot.
Because it's like this compliment at the same time is a command. And I also think that having a name that's a little more abstract, a little hipper, and it's a little bit less, I don't know if it's hipper, but if it was called Passive Revenue Podcast, could I get Steve Case to come on probably the podcast? Not. Could I get Jason Fried to come on my podcast? There's something, if there has like a certain bit of coolness to it, then I feel like it's a little easier to get the bigger names on there.
Yeah.
As opposed to, a podcast is very niche. So it's this paradox. It's like a risk that you take is I'm going to have a more abstract name. It's going to be harder to gain traction at first. But once I get that traction, my thinking is at least that it can be deeper. And that's really what it's all about for me is like, it's just depth these days. I've got a decent email list and now I'm more interested in, the fact that somebody will download something of me and another person talking and listen to it while they're doing things like that's huge.
Awesome.
There's so much impact. And if they get near as much joy out of listening to my podcast as I get out of listening to other podcasts, like that's amazing.
And you have very positive feedback so far, right?
Yeah, the feedback's good. I mean, even Jason Fried, said consistently guests tell me they think that I ask good questions. I don't know if that's something they tell everybody. Could be. Feedback is good.
When did you launch, Dave?
It's not exploding. December. I launched in December. It's not exploding in popularity. It's like I just beat my single day download record today with Jeff Goins' interview. I had roughly 1,430 downloads today.
And what's the total?
What's
the total for every episode? For every episode of the show.
Jason Fried has a little over 5,000 downloads. My latest episode very quickly got to 3,000. I don't know how it did that quickly. But the average is around 2,700 or so for the 26 episodes that I have. So I've been doing 6 months. I had a base to start with. I think that a lot of podcasters would be thrilled to be getting the number of downloads that I'm getting after 6 months. But I'm getting impatient. I want more downloads, but I'm not going to pod fade anytime soon. I realize it's something that I really love to do.
And is it hard to get guests on the show for you, or like high caliber guests? How do you do that?
I try to socially engineer it where possible. And that, I started with friends who did particular things where I thought that they would have a good story or theme that would fit the theme of the podcast. And then it seemed like a lot of people who I thought of were then in some way connected with some of those friends. So I'm fortunate. I have a decent network, got a decent list size, and I can always say that, I was like, oh, I want to promote your book to my 35,000 email subscribers, et cetera, et cetera. And, like Steve Case was, for me, that was like a Hail Mary. And even, Jason Fried was a Hail Mary too. It's like, yeah, I knew the guy knew that I existed, but I was nervous to ask some of these people to come on.
So Steve Case is the
some of them said
Steve
yes.
Case is the previous or the first CEO of America Online, and Jason Fried, just for our listeners.
Yeah, Jason Fried is the CEO of Basecamp and the New York Times bestselling author of Rework. He's got some other books. I don't know if those are New York Times bestsellers or not, but very popular in the software as a service entrepreneurship world. Extremely popular. And I've got a lot of other great big guests too, but sometimes I socially engineer it, and I try to make my pitches are very respectful. It's like, I've done the research. I have an idea about why you're the right guest for this. Here's what I want to do for you. And I email them, and a lot of it's Hail Marys too. There's plenty of people I've emailed who I never heard back from or who turned me down. Plenty. And that was so emotionally difficult the first couple times, but now I can't even hardly remember the number of people who've turned me down or who've not responded. Like, dude, I emailed Louis C.K. a couple of weeks ago to ask him to be on. Like, there's no way he's going to come on my podcast, but it'd be cool if he did. So I tried at least.
Yep. That would be very cool if he did.
I mean, I know exactly the type of interview it would be. I think it would be a great interview with original stuff. But we'll see. Hopefully I won't ever run out of people. Which if I do, if there's no more people that I'm curious about the story I can tell with them, then maybe I'm done. But I don't want to become a factory.
So I think this is a good point to start wrapping things up. Dave, listening to you talk, I was thinking this podcast is called Unstagnate. Whether or not, like in your podcast, we're going to be talking just about work, just about stagnation or getting unstuck, you've certainly been very much with the theme of things here. You got unstuck quite a few times. Mm-hmm. You uprooted yourself from Silicon Valley, you became a writer, and then you use that to leverage yourself into assisting people with productivity, and now your podcast. On top of that, awesome blogger. I love your work. Ah, see what I did there? awesome blogger and a new podcaster. And so if people want to find you on the interwebs, where do they go? Where do they go to get the best of you?
I am at Kadavy on Twitter. That is Kadavy. That is a great place. If they are interested in learning design stuff for me, designforhackers.com. My blog is kadavy.net, which has my podcast, Love Your Work, on it. Love Your Work is on iTunes. there's too many calls to action here. It's going to make it difficult for people to know what to do. And I've been writing on Medium a lot lately. 500 words every weekday. Kadavy.
So as someone who's been shadowing you for the last week, trying to find out as much as I can, I think kadavy.net is the hub of it all, and that's where they could find your Twitter And that's where they could find links to your to Design for Hackers. And,
yeah.
Yeah. So Kadavy.net. Dave Kadavy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
All right.
Love Your Work is brought to you in part by Audible, and they'd like to give you a free audiobook. Choose from over 180,000 audiobooks on any subject you can imagine. Just go to kadavy.net/audible to claim your free audiobook. So there we go. As you can see, Almog is a very good interviewer, and he's just getting started. So check out the rest of his episodes on the Unstagnate podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're interested in some of the neuroscience that I was talking about behind the productivity hacks that I developed for myself, be sure to check out neuroscientist John Cuneo's on episode 8. And before I go, I've got to ask, do you like books? If you do, sign up for my book recommendations. About 90% will be nonfiction on subjects spanning from biographies to neuroscience. Just go to kadavy.net/reading and get the first set of recommendations right away. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Kadavy. The theme music for this show is CNU, performed by the Album Leaf, courtesy of Sub Pop Records. Love Your Work is a production of Kadavy.